Thank you, ladies, and good morning, everyone. It's good to be back with you, and I also want to say welcome to those watching via the live stream and those who are joining us here at 11 o'clock today. We have been looking at some soaring theology, have the mind of Christ, work, for it is God who works in you to will and act, some soaring theology, and we might have thought that we would get to hang out with these intellectual thoughts for a while. Just enjoy them and revel them in them. But we are going to see today that Paul immediately moves us from these thoughts back to reality, back to feet on the ground, ordinary life, to things like travel plans and illness. All right, now, life has a way of doing this to us in general, bringing us down from the clouds back down to earth, right? Life has a way of doing this to us in general. Danielle and I had only been married a short period of time when I noticed something. When he was playing, Danielle was a big Brett Favre fan. He's the reason why she roots for the Packers. Such a big Favre fan, she even followed Minnesota for that weird year or two when he was a Viking. I'm a huge Brett Favre fan, and when we were first married, every Sunday, our habit generally was to go home from church and go to our parents' house and turn on the TV and watch football. And so every single Sunday, there would be Brett Favre. She'd be watching Brett Favre. And I started to think, this is no different from when she was single. You know, what am I here for? So finally one day, I said, Danielle, honey, if you took away all of Brett Favre's athletic ability, if you took away all the money he had from that athletic ability, if you took away his rugged good looks, his gene commercials, if you took away all of those surface things, what would you have? She didn't miss a beat. She looked at me and she said, I'd have you. Life has a way of doing this to us, doesn't it? Bring us head in the clouds, back down to reality. Life does it to us in general. Paul does it on purpose. Right? Paul does it absolutely intentionally, deliberately. Soaring theology today, we're going to see he's doing all of it with his feet planted firmly on solid earth. He says our thinking and our acting, our living are absolutely intermingled. What you think and how you behave have to go together. If there was ever a passage that blows monasticism out of the water, it's Philippians chapter 2. Monasticism, the idea that to be holy, you need to be a monk. You need to withdraw from the world, you know, sequester yourself off on your own. That's what it means to be like God. If there's ever a passage that undercuts that, that short circuits it at its core, it's this one, Philippians chapter 2. We're going to see, number one, the Christian life as a matter of integration. What we believe and how we act absolutely go together, a matter of integration. We're going to see, number two, the Christian life in relation to frustration. The difficulties that we deal with in our day-to-day living, the Christian life in relation to frustration, irritation. And then we're going to see, number three, the Christian life and the question of imitation. Having an example to follow, a role model to follow. The question or the role of duplication, having somebody to copy. Head in the clouds, feet on the ground. What all this theology has to do with ordinary living, how to live, daily life, how to live with joy. This is the rest of Philippians chapter 2, verses 19 through 30. Paul writes, I hope in the Lord Jesus to send Timothy to you soon, that I also may be cheered when I receive news about you. For I have no one else like him who takes a genuine interest in your welfare. For everyone looks out for his own interests, not those of Jesus Christ. But you know that Timothy has proved himself, because as a son with his father, he has served with me in the work of the gospel. I hope, therefore, to send him as soon as I see how things go with me, and I am confident in the Lord that I myself will come soon. But I think it is necessary to send back to you Epaphroditus, my brother, fellow worker, and fellow soldier, who is also your messenger, whom you sent to take care of my needs. For he longs for all of you and is distressed because you heard he was ill. Indeed, he was ill and almost died. But God had mercy on him, and not on him only, but also on me, to spare me sorrow upon sorrow. Therefore, I am all the more eager to send him, so that when you see him again, you may be glad, and I may have less anxiety. Welcome him in the Lord with great joy, and honor men like him, because he almost died for the work of Christ, risking his life to make up for the help you could not give me. The word of the Lord. First, the Christian life as a matter of integration. The story is told of a husband and wife where the husband became very sick. He was mysteriously ill. They could not figure out what was wrong with him. Finally, they went to the doctor, tried to figure out what was going on. The doctor examined the husband, and after examining him, called the wife into his office to explain what was going on. And the doctor said to the wife, "If you want your husband to live, you need to wait on him hand and foot. You need to serve him 24/7. You need to take care of his every need. You need to do your absolute best never to provoke him, never to give him any cause to be disgruntled. Right? You need to take care of his every need. And if you do that, he will live." Do you understand what I am telling to you? It's a very rare and serious condition. And I will point out, husbands, it's a very rare condition. He says, "Do you understand?" The wife said, "Yes." She leaves the doctor's office, goes back to her husband. The husband says, "What's the news?" And the wife said, "You're never going to make it." Doc says, "You don't have a chance." We instinctively know that there is a problem when our behavior does not match up with our words. Right? We know that. When our actions don't match up with what we have professed, with what we claim to believe, to think, "I'll love you forever, for better, for worse, in sickness and in health, you're never going to make it. Refuse to serve you." We know there's a problem when those two things don't go together. There's to be a wholeness. There's to be an integration between what we say, what we think and believe, and how we act, how we live. You see, a Christian is someone who cannot pie graph out their life slice by slice and say, "This slice, God, this one is yours." A Christian cannot do that. No, a Christian is somebody who pie graphs out their life slice by slice, family, work, fun, church, small group, all of these different sorts of things. They pie graph out their life, and then they look at God and they say, "And it's yours. It's all yours. Every single piece, every single part of it." There's to be an integration across the whole of who we are, an integration at the core of our being. You can't find any part of us that does not belong to God. It has been said that we all live either in Philippians 1:21 or in Philippians 2:21. Philippians 1:21, "For to me to live is Christ, to die is gain." Philippians 2:21, "Everyone looks out for his own interests, not those of Jesus Christ." And it's one or the other. We all live in one or the other. Either all of life is Christ, or he has none of it in reality. If you divvy up your life and you can look at God and say, "This slice is yours," no matter how big that slice is, what it means is you are deciding, "I will give this much to God, and whenever it crosses this certain line, I'm not going to give him anymore." It's your interest. It's how much you're comfortable with, not giving him all. Paul moves from soaring theology to things like travel plans. Who's going to visit who and where they're going to go and when? Things like travel plans and illness. It seems like a big change of gear to us. How can he do that? There's an integration for Paul. He starts off the chapter by saying, "You're having practical problems? You need to fix your view of Christ. Fix your view of the Trinity." And now he's saying, "You have these great views of Christ and the Trinity? It needs to flesh itself out in your daily living. It will flesh itself out sooner or later in how you actually go about ordinary life." We saw that all behavioral issues are inherently theological. Today we see that all theology is inherently practical. Theology is inherently behavioral. What we believe will, whether we like it or not, show itself in how we are living. If you were ever part of a study, a series on the book of Philippians before, a sermon series, a Bible study, if you were ever part of a series out of this book before and any part of the book was skipped, whether for time, you know, not enough weeks, or for interest, if any part was skipped, I guarantee you it was this passage. We don't know what to do with it, usually. There's no direct teaching. There are no direct commands, virtually, from Paul to the rest of us. It's just, who's traveling? Who's sick? So often we skip it, but we miss out big time if we pass over this. Paul is modeling how our theology trickles down into ordinary living. There's a Christian professor of philosophy named Esther Meek, and she has said that knowing at its heart is an act, and to act is to live or embody knowledge. They go together, knowing and acting. We're actually going to participate in this acted knowing at the end of the service. But there's an integration between the two. I'll put it to you this way. When you meet this God, integration means it will affect everything about you. Think about it this way. When somebody wins the lottery, how do they react? I'm not talking $100 at the gas station. I'm talking the big one, the Powerball, $100 million. And no, I'm not condoning either form, right? Don't do the lottery. It's bad math. But when somebody wins the lottery, how do they react? You know, before they receive the phone call, they don't have $100 million. They get one phone call, all of a sudden they have $100 million. How do they react? That's nice. No. How do they react? Their whole being is thrust into action, right? Bodily, they respond. They're probably jumping up and down. Vocally, they are into it. They're probably shouting. It affects everything about them. Their thoughts, their emotions, their behaviors. Their daily decisions are affected. Their purchasing patterns are changed. They have been integrated around the encounter, the news of winning the lottery. When somebody meets a copperhead in the woods, they're looking at a pattern on the forest floor, trying to figure out what it is. Maybe they even get down real close to look at it. And when they realize this is not just a pattern, this is a copperhead, how do they react? What do you know? Poisonous snake. Is that how they react? No, they're integrated. They are transformed by the encounter. Their whole being is thrust into action. Bodily, they run. Adrenaline kicks in. Vocally, they scream, at least if you're like me. Everything about them is now transformed by the encounter to get away from that snake as soon as possible. So here's the question. If you meet the God of the universe, is that a bigger or smaller encounter than winning the lottery or chancing upon a copperhead? Should there be more or less integration of your whole being? If you meet the God that Paul is talking about in Philippians 2, 5 through 11, Son with His Father, with Holy Spirit, giving of themselves, giving all they have to be with you out of great love for you, if you meet that God, will that encounter transform your whole life more or less than finding a copperhead in the woods? It's more. And so if somebody would look at your life, would they see that? If your friends, your family looked at your life, would they see a level of integration befitting that kind of encounter? And if not, what needs to change? What's the next step? There's to be an integration in the Christian life. Paul says, I have this mindset, and that integrates all my daily living around Him. First. Second. The Christian life in relation to frustration. Couple things here. First, low-hanging fruit, though we still often miss it. Epaphroditus is sick, right? Verses 25 through 27, this man, Epaphroditus, is sick. Now here's the thing. This fellow, Epaphroditus, was with somebody named Paul. The Apostle Paul. He was with the Apostle Paul, who, I will remind you, healed sick people, raised people from the dead, who napkins would touch him, and they would take the napkins and touch somebody who was sick, and Paul wasn't even around, and the sick person would be made well. He is with that Paul, and Paul says, I'm going to send him back because he's ill. The Christian life is not always one great march of victory, avoiding one difficulty after another. Sometimes the divine word to us is not so much, I will get you out of this, as it is, I will be with you through this. Not, I will relieve you from the suffering, but I will deliver you in the suffering. I mean, even if Epaphroditus' healing was an answer to prayer, notice it hardly seems to be a quick snap of the fingers and done. You know, no, this was prolonged. This was severe. He almost died. He had to be sent back because he was sick. The Christian life, even when we're wholly centered around God, still faces difficulty and has the honesty to admit it. As this idea of difficulty keeps coming up, in no small part because Paul is still in prison the whole way through the letter. But as we talk about chains, we are using them to represent external circumstances, not sins. The biblical word to us is always flee your sins right away. Don't tolerate them. Don't say, I'm just going to stay in my sin and experience God's mercy in the midst of it. The biblical word is always to get out of sin as soon as possible, but suffering may or may not be taken away quickly. Pastor Tim Keller, in his commentary on Psalm 103, writes, the reason is because sin always blocks our relationship with God. Sin always blocks our relationship with God, but suffering can deepen it. Psalm 119:67, before I was afflicted, I went astray. Now I obey your word after I was afflicted. Psalm 119:71, it was good for me to be afflicted so I might learn your decrees. 119:75, in faithfulness, you have afflicted me. Sin, you got to deal with right away. Suffering, you might get relieved right away, or you might be trained, chastened, shaped through it. Sin is always a barrier with our relationship with God. Suffering might deepen it. The Christian life, even as we contemplate and believe these grand truths, deals with bodily affliction and weakness. The truths and the affliction are not in opposition to one another. In fact, they are integrated. The theology and the suffering are integrated, as we will see. There's a sickness here, but beyond even the sickness, there is something else. There is more than the hint of failure, of difficulty, of a frustration and irritation of a different sort. Paul is honoring Epaphroditus, but he is honoring Epaphroditus, no doubt, in part, because the Philippians would have had every reason, every natural reason, to consider this man a failure, a disappointment. Commentators are mixed on this. Some give nothing but praise for Epaphroditus. Using Paul's own words, fellow soldier, worker, risked his life. Yet other commentators pick up on something that I believe we are meant to see here. They point out that Paul is saying all of these glowing things in the midst of other indicators that there was a failed mission. Even reminding the Philippians of their close association with Epaphroditus so as to stress it was their selection of him in the first place. You sent him to take care of my needs. He was your messenger. But if they sent him, they would have been asking, why is he coming back so soon? Didn't he finish the job? Or didn't he do a good enough job? Paul's prison was far enough away. It was a source of distress for the Philippians. They couldn't minister to him directly. Far enough away for that, but close enough to the Philippians to allow a whole bunch of trips to take place back and forth. I mean, process through it with me. Paul gets put in prison, and news reaches the Philippians. And so the Philippians send Epaphroditus, and Epaphroditus reaches Paul. Epaphroditus gets sick. News reaches the Philippians that Epaphroditus is sick over here. then they get either anxious or worried or whatever their response is, and news reaches Epaphroditus that they've heard that he is sick, and he gets distressed. And so as a result, Paul's going to send Epaphroditus back to the Philippians. There's all kinds of back and forth between these two, and the whole thing that would have been building throughout was this overwhelming impression. We sent this man to accomplish a mission, and he let us down. He got sick on the job. He couldn't follow through. We all know what it's like to be on group trips, these overseas trips, missions trips, and you have some people, don't we all know what it's like? You have some people who shoulder extra burdens, and you have some people who create extra burdens. And in my life, there have been times where I've been each one of those. Most earnestly, there have been plenty of times where I thought I was in the position of strength, and I was actually creating the greatest hindrance to the whole reason why we were there in the first place. But we know what this is like. And in Epaphroditus, the Philippians are dealing with, what do you do when someone lets you down? When someone causes anxiety to the group, and Paul calls the Philippians to honor him. To honor him. There's no contradiction between verse 29 and verse 3. You know, verse 3, each one should look not to their own interests, but to the interests of others. Seek no honor for themselves. And yet the Christian community is to honor people who do that. Honor those who seek no honor for themselves. This is the nature of Christian fellowship. Paul calls us to it, and then Paul models what he is calling them to. He focuses not on his failures, but on the fact that this man gave everything he had for the work of the gospel. Now, related, but just a sidebar here for a moment. Paul has feelings too. Notice this. Paul has feelings too, that I may have less anxiety. The opposite of natural is not supernatural. The opposite of natural is unnatural. To be a Christian, to have this supernatural existence, is not to be unnatural. No, Paul has everyday normal human desires and emotions. He wants Epaphroditus to be okay. He wants there to be a reunion. He wants news that the Philippians and Epaphroditus are together again. He has feelings too. To be a Christian is not to be a robot. Yet in relation to these regular human desires and emotions, when we come up against frustrations and difficulties, hindrances to them, the Christian life is not to get caught up in the frustration, but to display Christ in the midst of it. To display Christ. That's what Paul is calling them to. And that's what Paul is calling us to. Does it sound like a tall task? 3. Look what he does next. In the midst of calling and demonstrating this very high standard, Paul lays out 3 examples for us. Timothy, Epaphroditus, and Paul himself. And what a spread they are. Paul, a Jew of Jews, as we will see in the coming weeks. Timothy, a Jew-Gentile mix. Epaphroditus, a convert from utter paganism. He was named for the goddess Aphrodite. What a spread. And Paul is saying, look, people from all walks of life living this way. He lays out this very high standard, and then, as if anticipating our objections to it, says, no, 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 don't let yourselves off the hook. Look, it can be done. It really can be done. Timothy, first paragraph, 19 through 25. Timothy modeling the selfless behavior Paul is calling us to. Epaphroditus, even in weakness, emptying himself of all he had. Paul would have had plenty to complain about both of them. Paul would have had plenty to criticize them about. Timothy had his weaknesses. You know that. Epaphroditus, we've covered. As an older man, Paul could have just focused on the negative. He could have given in to being the grumpy old man. Think about the feelings you have toward youth in our culture. Ever wrestle with frustration? Discouragement? Focusing on the negative? An older person once wrote this. See if this sounds familiar. They said, our youth now love luxury. They have bad manners, contempt for authority, and disrespect for older people. Children nowadays are tyrants. They no longer rise when their elders enter the room. They contradict their parents. They chatter when company is present. They gobble their food. And they tyrannize their teachers. Sound familiar? You know who wrote that? Socrates. 2,400 years ago. What's the point? The older generation always has a reason to be discouraged with the younger. And a bent toward being discouraged. Right? But that's a bent, a disposition, and a reason to be frustrated with youth. And Paul says he's found something different. Paul says he's found something that totally changes that disposition. He sees the good in these men. He holds them up as examples. He focuses not on the negative, but on the positive. And in so doing, he himself models what he is commanding of us. Look not to your own interest, but to the interest of others. I'm going to send Epaphroditus not for my good, but for the Philippians' good. And later I'm going to do the same with Timothy. Consider others better than yourselves. Look at these men, he says. Look at what examples they are. Struggling with the high calling of Philippians 2, look at the examples. Timothy, Epaphroditus, and Paul himself. Look at the models for us to follow. And yet, the Christian life has never been merely about look at these examples and shape up. Look at these good role models and fall in line and imitate them. The Christian life has never merely been that. How does it work? As Casey mentioned last week, I was speaking at a college retreat, and one of the staff at that retreat shared an article with me entitled, Hearing the Music of the Gospel. And the point of the article was this. Imagine a house in which two different kinds of people live. In this house, you have some people, one group, who can hear, and you have another group who cannot hear, a group who is deaf. And imagine one of the ones who can hear is sitting in the living room listening to music. And as they're listening to music, they just start to, you know, subconsciously just start to bob along. Just kind of start to jive, you know, get into it. This is the most dancing you'll see in this pulpit for a very long time, right? They just sort of start to get into it. And as they are sitting listening to music, enjoying it, one of the ones who's deaf comes in. And they can't hear the music, but they sit down opposite this person, just sort of watching them. They sort of start to do the same thing. The same movements. Just kind of start to get into it as well. If you were a silent observer watching them, you might very well have no idea which one can hear and which one cannot. They would look very, very similar, but they're having totally different experiences, aren't they? One of them is enjoying the music itself. The other one is just copying somebody else. The exact same thing happens spiritually, religiously, in this room. Two kinds of people. Some whose ears have been opened to hear the music of the gospel directly, they are responding directly to it, and others who are just watching what everyone else is doing and falling in line, copying. Mimicking. Which one are you? Are you just going with the flow? Or have you heard the gospel yourself? Only then, the real answer is not just imitate Paul and Epaphroditus and Timothy. The real answer is hear the same gospel they were hearing, and then they will be a helpful model for you. And what is that gospel? Without it, when you don't serve God with your whole heart, what you have instead is fragmentation, a fractured existence, disintegration. If you don't give God your whole heart, you have instead a fractured existence. When Jesus Christ goes to the cross, what happened? The earth shook. The rocks split. Darkness came over all the earth. What was happening? Creation was disintegrating. Jesus Christ took on himself at the cross the fragmentation we all deserve, the fractured existence we all have, and thereby taking our disintegration on himself, he makes it possible. He gives us his whole heart. He puts his wholehearted love for God in us. He gives us wholeheartedness, integration around the Father by taking on our suffering, our frustration. Only then does he become an example that we might follow. Paul says Timothy proved himself because as a son with his father, he has served with me. All of Paul's original hearers would have expected as a son served for his father. He doesn't say for, he says with. He's reminding us of the hymn, verses 5 through 11. A son with his father giving all. This is the gospel. Even as Epaphroditus' near death also reflects Christ's great sacrifice for us. When we hear the gospel, the work and the relationships of the Trinity begin extending themselves in our own relationships. Over and over, Paul says, in the Lord, in the Lord, in the Lord. I hope in the Lord. He knows what it is to hold all of his decisions with an open hand. Say, it doesn't depend what Nero decides. Whatever happens to me is not about Nero's change, it's about what the Lord wants in my life. He holds all his decisions in the Lord. He knows what it is to have indwelling strength, him in the Lord, and the Lord in him. When you hear the gospel yourself, you will begin to have this kind of wholehearted, integrated life as well.